On April 18th of this year, the first major protests in Nicaragua began. Students went out into the streets in reaction to a new policy about Social Security. But things started escalating very quickly. Protesters were being attacked by the police and by armed groups, and they were fighting back with rocks and sticks. If you were in Nicaragua and you were at home on that day, you might not have even known that people were being attacked in the streets. And that's because news broadcasts covering the protests had been cut by the government. Instead, you might have been watching telenovelas.
¿Tantas ganas me traes?
La verdad, sí.
Now, 3 months later, there are about 300 dead in clashes across the country, and the protests continue with the country in crisis. So today, we're asking this question: what's happening in Nicaragua, and how did we get here? From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and today, the crisis in Nicaragua. I'm joined in the studio by Latino USA producer Saire Quevedo, who's going to help us understand exactly what's happening and how we got to this place in Nicaragua. So, Saire, where do you want to start with this story?
Well, to understand what's happening today, we actually have to go back a few decades. So we're going to start in 1979. Anastasio Somoza was the president of Nicaragua. He's a dictator, and his family has been in power since the 1930s. So it's about 43 or so years of Somoza rule, and by all accounts, it's a pretty brutal dictatorship.
In fact, Saire, let me give you an example. So in the mid-1970s, there was a horrible earthquake that struck Nicaragua, and people from all over the world were sending donations. And I remember there were a lot of blood donations. And later it turned out that the Somoza government had been accused of selling that blood to make money.
Yeah, and their regime is sort of just widely recognized as being pretty corrupt and pretty repressive. And in 1979, the Somoza regime was about to be overthrown by a leftist rebel group. So Somoza had started bombing his own people.
You've said, I think I'm right, that the exercise that you were engaged in was to protect the people of Nicaragua. From the outside, bombing seems a rather curious form of protection. Could you explain why you decided to do that?
To maintain the peace in the country is a way of protecting the people. Neutralizing those who break the peace, it's also a form of protecting the people.
In 1979, during this uprising, Victoria González Rivera was a kid.
July 1979, the news coverage on Nicaragua was daily. And we saw the bombing on TV, and we saw all the atrocities.
Victoria's parents had sent her to the U.S. to keep her safe, but they themselves were still in Nicaragua.
At that time, we didn't know whether my parents were alive or not, and that was pretty intense for a 10-year-old. Unfortunately, like most Nicaraguans of my age, I have many memories like this.
And Victoria's going to help us with the history of Nicaragua leading up to now. She's a professor of Chicano studies at the University of San Diego, and she's written a bunch of books about women and politics in Nicaragua. And this insurrection that Victoria was watching on television was the world's first introduction to the FSLN, the Sandinista National Front for Liberation, or as they're commonly known, the Sandinistas.
Patria libre! Patria libre! Patria o muerte! Venceremos!
The Sandinistas were revolutionaries. They wanted to overthrow Anastasio Somoza and his regime. And they were inspired by Augusto Sandino, who was a Nicaraguan peasant revolutionary from the 1930s. And these young revolutionaries took the name of Sandino and named themselves Sandinistas. So in the name of Sandino, we are taking back our country. It was a very nationalistic and leftist revolutionary movement that actually succeeded in toppling a government.
Victoria's Sandinista rebels marched into Nicaragua's capital city of Managua today. They met only small pockets of resistance. Isolated bands of National Guardsmen they quickly overran.
And in the case of Nicaragua, the Sandinistas come to power, and they were different from other leftist revolutions, especially the main comparison was with Cuba. And the Sandinistas were way more open, way more democratic than the Cuban Revolution. And that gave a lot of people hope. And so it was very, very inspirational for many, many people.
But for Ronald Reagan, U.S. president at the time, it was a nightmare come true. He was terrified that communism was going to spread across Central America, with Nicaragua as the beginning seed of that. So after the Sandinistas achieved power, the Nicaraguan right wing that was against them began to receive aid from the U.S. government. And that aid was used to form what is now known as the Contras. Right-wing paramilitary is basically like an unofficial military group specifically formed to fight against the Sandinista government.
We have an obligation to be of help where we can to freedom fighters, lovers of freedom and democracy, from Afghanistan to Nicaragua.
The way that Ronald Reagan talked about this was that communists were actually on the U.S.-Mexico border and they were prepared to flood into the United States. That was the image that Americans had, was that the communists, the Sandinistas, were ready to take over and come into the United States.
Yeah, and the Contra War, funded in part by the U.S., ended up claiming 30,000 lives. And on top of this, the U.S. ends up embargoing Nicaragua, and it was just generally like a really scary time to be in the country. And Daniel Ortega, which is a name that you should remember because it will come up again, was president at the time. He was president from 1985 until 1990. And in 1990, a ceasefire is called.
The seemingly impossible happened in Nicaragua. The Contras, mortal enemies of the Sandinista revolutionaries who dominated the country for more than 10 years, laid down their arms.
And the Sandinistas agreed to hold elections.
And they lost against Violeta Barrio de Chamorro. She won, and the FSLN peacefully turned over power.
And she says that it was actually a really big deal because this was one of the first times that a revolutionary group that had overthrown a government stepped down peacefully after losing an election. And so from then on, there were sort of various presidents from different parties and politics until 2006, when the Sandinistas won the election again with Daniel Ortega, the same one I mentioned earlier, who had served 5 years as president during the time of the revolution.
Y hemos dado ya el primer paso a llevar estos procesos electorales con mensajes que llenen de esperanza a nuestro pueblo.
And so he came in many ways to symbolize the Sandinistas for good and bad, because, of course, he had such a high profile during the revolution.
But the thing is that this second presidency was very different than the revolutionary years, because this time Ortega made alliances with right-wing politicians, he aligned himself with the Catholic Church, and his platform and his politics were just way more conservative than they had been in the past. And there were a bunch of other things that made him super unpopular. Like, there were accusations of corruption. There was this creeping nepotism. His wife, Rosario Murillo, ends up becoming vice president. And his kids go on to own or manage a number of really important media companies and advertising firms in Nicaragua. And Murillo, his wife, is in charge of government communication and actually ends up often acting as his mouthpiece. And he was also accused of molesting his stepdaughter and basically, alongside his wife, aka her mom and the vice president, convinced everyone that his stepdaughter was a pathological liar. And Ortega also changed the constitution to give himself unlimited presidential terms and purged the FSLN political party of anyone that disagreed with him.
And so the FSLN became not a minority party, because clearly, you know, there are many Nicaraguans who support Daniel even today, even after everything that has happened, but certainly one where dissent was not allowed. But then in April, things just spiraled out of control.
We find out what happened after the break. Stay with us. No te vayas.
I'm Shankar Vedantam, host of the podcast Hidden Brain. All summer long, we're sharing stories about reinventing yourself as part of a series that we call You 2.0.
Rebels are not troublemakers. They're people who break rules that should be broken.
Subscribe and embrace your inner rebel. No leather jacket required.
Okay, we're back. And before, Latino USA producer Zaire Quevedo was explaining to us what led up to what we're seeing in Nicaragua today. And we're also joined by historian Victoria González Rivera. So, Zaire, what exactly was it that instigated these most recent protests in April?
So it's two things. First is that back in 2013, Daniel Ortega, the president of Nicaragua, made a deal with a company based out of Hong Kong called HKND, the Hong Kong-Nicaragua Canal Development Investment Company. And basically, what he did was he granted them a 50-year concession to build and operate a canal in Nicaragua. For years, China has wanted a canal to compete with the Panama Canal. But there was no transparency around this. He granted the company rights over any land that they chose, even land that was already owned by private citizens. And the company was also permitted to sell the rights of the canal to whoever they chose.
And this is a really big deal because what Daniel Ortega was allowing the Chinese to do was essentially slice the country in half.
And it was an even bigger deal that he hadn't consulted with anyone in the country about this. They found out about it after the fact. And then the second thing. So this year, Ortega proposed major Social Security reforms. The changes increased the amount paid into the Social Security system by workers and employers, but reduced the pensions of retired workers. So basically what that means is that people would be paying more into the Social Security system, but be receiving less benefits when they retire. It's meant to boost Social Security in the country because it's in a deficit right now. And so these protests start in response to the Social Security reforms. But they're also about all of these other things that have just kind of added up over time. In this video from the first day of the protest, you can see some young people at the National University. They're standing around, some of them have signs in their hand, and then suddenly, everyone starts to run. And these Ortega supporters have started hurling rocks at them, and they're wearing white shirts, and one of them is holding what looks like a big stick. You know, around the same time, there's this wave of anti-corruption protests all over the region, in Honduras, in Guatemala, and that's all to say that, you know, these kind of protests were normal, but what wasn't normal is what happened next. The police response was aggressive. They used rubber bullets and tear gas against peaceful protesters, and the situation quickly escalated. In another video from the same day, a young man lays bloodied on the street with a crowd around him. According to the person who uploaded the video, he's a university student who was shot dead by the police. Even though these protests started out about the canal and Social Security, police brutality became the focal point of people's anger. More protests started breaking out. In some videos, another presence begins to emerge. Sometimes they're wearing motorcycle helmets. Often they're wearing shirts with government or Sandinista slogans on them. And they're almost always in groups. In the videos, they're described as turbas, or mobs. And they're attacking journalists and activists at the marches. These are members of pro-Ortega groups that start showing up at the protests. In this video, you can see the march passing by. This guy is taking photos off on the side, and a mob of pro-Ortega people grab the camera, throw it on the floor, and just start punching him. In her daily briefing to The Nation, Rosario Murillo, the vice president and Ortega's wife, had this to say about the protesters.
Qué tristeza da la manipulación política de los mismos de siempre. Esos minúsculos grupos que asusan y desestabilizan para destruir Nicaragua.
She says, how sad. We're seeing the same political manipulation from the same people as always. These tiny groups that inflame and destabilize in order to destroy Nicaragua. By the end of the week, nearly 27 people were dead. It was a level of violence against protesters that hadn't been seen in the country for decades. Ortega withdrew the proposal for Social Security reforms a few days later, but also said that if protesters didn't stop, that he would take measures to regain peace in the country. which sounded to a lot of folks like a veiled threat.
There was a point where the government, Ortega's government, could have stepped back and said, oh, whoa, we're sorry, we made a mistake, and we will punish those individuals who were involved in those specific acts of violence against unarmed civilians who have a right to protest peacefully. But they didn't.
Protests continued. And by the second week, students had taken one of the universities, and by the first month, barricades had begun to pop up across the country. In a speech last week given at a rally, Daniel Ortega compares the protesters and those who support them to Cain from the Bible, killing their brothers. He calls them sowers of hate, terrorists, and killers.
Los que financian, los que estimulan, los que justifican estos crímenes, asesinos, asesinos.
Over time, protesters begin to use these homemade weapons, and then at the same time, pro-Ortega mobs in the streets become more militant, and they begin to evolve. Like, you remember I was describing them before, and they were wearing the motorcycle helmets, and they're carrying sticks? Well, now you see them, and they're decked out in military fatigues, and they have automatic weapons, and people start referring to them as paramilitaries.
Who are they?
Well, the government hasn't formally acknowledged these groups, but a report by Amnesty International claims what is already widely believed, which is that the government and the police are working alongside these paramilitary groups to get rid of the opposition.
The paramilitaries will often travel with the police. And so that's how you know that their link, they're affiliated with the police, is because they're right there and they see armed men with ski masks and they don't do anything about it. They all get into the same vehicles and they're all, you know, in the same places at the same time, right? Shooting at the same people.
And something to keep in mind is that this is a super messy situation, and much of the information we have comes from videos uploaded to YouTube and social media. And it can be really hard to verify information. But it's estimated that clashes between protesters and police or pro-Ortega supporters have resulted in around 300 dead. The vast majority of the dead are protesters, but some police and paramilitary members have died as well. A week ago, anti-Ortega protesters held a general strike, and student protesters who had taken the National University were attacked as pro-Ortega groups shot into a church on campus where students had barricaded themselves in. Two people were reportedly killed. In this video, a young woman hides behind a barricade at the National University during the attack. She's crying as shots ring out in the background.
Mama! Mama, perdóname! Salí a defender mi patria! Te amo, ¿viste?
She records the video as if it's her last moment, like it's a final message. She says, Mom, please forgive me. I came here to defend my country. According to reports, the young woman from this video, Valeska Sandoval, went missing a few days after the attack.
Oh, this is just so sad. And the thing that makes this conflict different than a lot of other Latin American political stories, in fact, even Nicaragua from just 35 years ago, is that this is no longer a typical left versus right kind of conflict.
No, exactly. So, like, the left is split, and there are these different factions, right? So there are students and protesters who believe Daniel Ortega is authoritarian and needs to go, and they see themselves as the left. But then we also have what are called Danielistas, people who are in support of Daniel Ortega, and they also see themselves as the left, as continuing the Sandinista revolution.
One of the things that those who still support Daniel Ortega have been saying, look, sure, Daniel Ortega, you know, is authoritarian. Fine. Sure, Daniel Ortega sold the rights to a canal in this secret deal. But whatever, you know, you have to focus on the positives, right? And the positives are that if he leaves under these conditions, then what's going to come next is going to be a right-wing government. And so it's better to have, you know, a bad leftist government than a right-wing government. So let's put up with all this. Let's put up with the state repression. Let's put up with the police brutality, because what would happen next is going to be terrible for Nicaragua.
Yeah, and there are other Danielistas as well who say that the protesters are actually part of a right-wing conspiracy to overthrow the government. And that seems to be the way the government sees it as well. Which, given the history of U.S. intervention in Central America and Nicaragua specifically, is kind of an understandable conspiracy theory.
So the people who support Daniel Ortega, they say that they're part of the left, but so do the people who are trying to overthrow him.
Yeah, and Victoria says that those on the right feel like this is basically just proof of what they already knew.
Saying, see, look, we knew all along that the FSLN was bad. We knew all along that communism was bad. We knew all along that socialism was bad. We would have been better if we had just stayed with Somoza.
In Victoria's personal opinion, it's not an indictment of the left.
It is an indictment of the adults who stood around and watched, right, an unfit man hijack a party and hijack a revolution that then left entire generations at his mercy.
And for Victoria, it's especially difficult because she's watching everything that's going down in her home country from afar through the shaky lens of Facebook Live videos.
I am absolutely heartbroken. Just speechless. Every single day I get hundreds of texts and emails and phone calls from blood relatives, friends, telling me live what's happening. Many of them are on hit lists, you know, kill lists.
And Victoria sends me one of those lists that she says she has family on. These kill lists are basically like announcements. The version I saw was a Facebook status, and it was an announcement to the citizens of this town that I'm not going to say the name of for the sake of the safety of the people who are on that list. But what it says is basically, stop making trouble, stop creating chaos. And then it gives this list of names of basically like the troublemakers who need to watch out. And then on the bottom of that list, it says plomo, which means bullet or lead. It's hard to tell how widespread this is, but a source on the ground says that there are similar lists in at least two other cities.
Right. So then basically these kinds of things are trying to intimidate people and essentially try to get them to stop going out to the streets to protest.
Once people are on the list, they're less likely to protest, and especially those who have families to support don't want to be targeted, don't want something to happen to them. But Victoria says that even with the kill lists and armed opposition, young people are still going out and protesting. We spoke to one of those protesters, and she asked to not have her name revealed because of the potential danger it could cause her. She fears she could be targeted by the paramilitaries. She was a student and a teacher before the protest started, and she says that honestly, before, she, like many people, had basically given up hope of the government changing. But after seeing people taking the streets, she felt motivated to do something.
They even call me kind of like an octopus sometimes, because I'm kind of like in between taking care of that, managing this, organizing that. Then they see me in a march. Then 2 hours later, I am getting their routine to take my kid to sleep. You know, it's like a nonstop thing, because we want our children to grow in a nation where they can express themselves and be heard.
She started organizing with her friends over social media, and now she spends her time bringing supplies like medicine and water to protesters and demanding for the release of those who've been arrested.
This is something that we will remember forever. We are being part of history. We are creating and demanding democracy in our country, and we are part of this movement. It's something that we'll tell our children and grandchildren.
At the same time, she says it's bittersweet because she grew up hearing stories from her parents and her grandparents about the Sandinista Revolution, the one they fought for alongside Daniel Ortega, And she says now they're fighting against Ortega, against the same repression all over again.
We need the world, we need the United States, we need every person to know what is really happening here. This is not a war. We don't have guns. We don't have anything that they are using against us. They are following us, they are chasing us, and they are killing us.
According to the Organization of American States, 273 people have died and 2,000 have been injured since April.
Saide, thank you so much for all of your reporting on this.
Thank you, Maria.
And our thanks to Victoria Gonzalez Rivera for your help with this story. This episode was reported by Saide Quevedo and edited by Marlon Bishop. The Latino USA team includes Miguel Macias, Sofia Paliza Carr, Antonia Cerejido, Andres Caballero, Maggie Freeling, and Janice Yamoka, with help from Fernanda Chavarri. Our engineers are Jeannie Montalvo and Stephanie LeBeau. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholz. Our fellows are Virginia Lora and Jesse Alejandro Cottrell. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Ruinos. And if you like the music you heard on this episode, be sure you stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us on our next episode. And in the meantime, I'll see you on all of your social media. Hasta la próxima. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by Heising Simons Foundation, unlocking knowledge, opportunity, and possibilities. More at hsfoundation.org. Winecoat Foundation, and with support from the Rockefeller Brothers Fund.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, a conversation with Grammy Award-winning artist Miguel.
My family journey has a lot to do with things like immigration, you know what I mean? And my grandmother coming here from Mexico.
That's next time on Latino USA. I want to tell you about something super exciting that's coming up, because this year Latino USA turns 25 years old, and we want to invite you to our birthday party. On Sunday, August 12th, we're teaming up with City Park Summer Stage to celebrate with Grammy winner Jerry Rivera, New Yorican poet La Bruja,
"Even if you ain't Boricua, can I call you my peeps?"
and famed percussionist Chembo Corniel. So come out, dance, and party with the Latino USA team in New York City's East River Park for free as we all get together to celebrate this important anniversary. I hope I'll see you there.
Did you know you can set your Amazon Echo to give you the news every morning? Just say, "Enable Up First." Then tomorrow, say, "What's the news?" and start your day with Up First.